welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. I'm Terry Patton, the creator and host for the series, and for anyone here who doesn't already know me, I'm also the founder and teacher of Integral Spiritual Practice and the author of Integral Life Practice with Ken Wilber. I created this series to advance the evolution of consciousness and culture by creating a deep public dialogue about how higher consciousness can play a real meaningful role in helping human beings to rise to meet our current challenges, to make as benign as possible a transition to a sustainable human presence on our planet. I've now held almost 90 remarkable conversations on this topic with many of today's leading thought leaders and spiritual teachers, and once you've registered at beyondawakeningseries.com, they are all available for free download at beyondawakeningseries.com/blog. This morning, I'm very excited to be joined by Irvin Laszlo, the world-famous philosopher, scientist, and visionary. We're going to continue this discussion in a conversation we're titling The Self-Actualizing Cosmos, the Akasha Revolution in Science and Human Consciousness. So the way this will work is I'll introduce Irvin, and then he and I will dialogue for about 40 minutes. We won't be able to take questions today, but I have some important announcements at the end, and I hope you'll stay for all that. Irvin Laszlo has had three careers: as a classical concert pianist, as an academic scientist, and a philosopher of science and systems, and as a visionary endeavoring to help transform global culture and consciousness. And in all three, he has achieved international renown. He's generally recognized as the founder of systems philosophy and general evolution theory. He serves as president of the Club of Budapest, chairman of the Irvin Laszlo Center for Advanced Study, chancellor of the Giordano Bruno New Paradigm University, and editor of World Futures, the Journal of New Paradigm Research. His appointments have included research grants at Yale and Princeton universities, professorships at a number of universities, including Northwestern, the University of Indiana, State University of New York, and others. In addition, he worked as program director for the United Nations Institute for Training and Research. Twice nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize, he was awarded the Goy Peace Prize in 2001. He's authored or co-authored more than 70 books, including collaborations with Ludwig Bertensley, Jonas Salk, Mikhail Gorbachev, Deepak Chopra, Peter Ustinov, and Barbara Marx Hubbard. And his books have been translated into over 20 languages. He's also published in excess of 400 articles and research papers. Something I really appreciate about Irvin is his intense sense of wonder and possibility and the brilliant intelligence he brings to that. I think it has a lot to do with why he's able to combine several diverse kinds of brilliance, drilling deep into specialized technical scientific knowledge, synthesizing the implications of diverse findings with remarkable holistic interdisciplinary brilliance, and taking to heart the spiritual and moral implications of those findings as a caring global citizen and leader, as a personal explorer of the evolution of human consciousness, and as a gracious and generous participant in the conversations that are taking place now at the leading edge of consciousness and culture, like he's doing today by appearing with me. So thank you so much for joining me today, Irvin. I'm grateful and honored that you've chosen to be here with us on Beyond Awakening.
Well, it's great to be here. I'm honored and pleased myself. There is such a wonderful build-up that anything I can say will be a calm down. But anyway, let's try to have a nice conversation.
Well, good. Well, in your book, by the same title as our dialogue today, The Self-Actualizing Cosmos, you say that mechanistic materialism, the dominant paradigm of our mainstream culture, is in a position very similar to that of the old Earth-centered Ptolemaic astronomy shortly before the acceptance of the fact that the Earth orbits the Sun, and not vice versa, or the early years of the 20th century when the Einsteinian paradigm was was supplanting the Newtonian one, and that a new paradigm is about to replace the old. What exactly is happening? How will it change our understanding of the cosmos and our place in it?
Well, science grows by leaps and bounds. It's not a smooth process. That's the whole notion of a paradigm that Thomas Kuhn introduced in the 1970s. The idea is there are some basic presuppositions, and you explore the world, the experiences, the experiments, in light of their paradigm. But sooner or later, errors accumulate. They are called anomalies, things you can't understand. And those things get more and more. For a while, the people who hold on to that paradigm try to patch up that basic scheme. They try to explain things in terms of that scheme, even if they have to add on something to it. You know, like the early astronomy before Copernicus and Kepler had all these spheres turning around the Earth, and they always had to add more and more spheres to be able to account for the observed movement of the planets. So this kind of auxiliary assumptions accumulate, and after a while it gets to the point where the whole paradigm becomes obscure. And then if there is another possibility, another key notion, another insight that explains the facts and does away with all these complexities, then scientists leap on it. And this is what happened most famously sort of over 100 years ago when the Newtonian paradigm broke down and Einstein's relativity came in its place. But it keeps happening all the time. It kept happening in psychology, in the life sciences, in the social sciences, not quite as dramatically as it did now. It was 110 years ago, actually. But it happens all the time. And now we are on the moment, on the threshold, where we see that this materialistic, mechanistic paradigm that conceives of the world as a series of mass points, according to Newton, or even in a more primitive sense, a bit and pieces of matter moving about in space under laws that are forever true and are mechanistic laws of interaction, one thing affecting another, like one billiard ball affecting another. This kind of notion of the world as being a set of billiard balls that was initially given some power, some energy, and is now running down. That was the basis of the Newtonian paradigm. Not the fault of poor Newton, who was a deeply spiritual person, by the way, but this is how we computed, this is how we explained phenomena. And then his followers took over and said, this is how the way the world is. And so this way of thinking is now overtaken by observations, by experiments, and we see that the world is not like that. It's not just matter moving about in empty space, it's an information field realm, where matter actually as such doesn't even exist. So we can talk about what the new one is. I just wanted to say why the old one is breaking down. It just can't keep up with the new observations.
Well, yes. And yet there's a new paradigm arriving, and it really offers a very different view of things. And one of the things that you point out is that it can be a source of guidance as to the nature of reality and a source of trustworthy ideas for rediscovering healthier and wiser relations to one another in the universe. How exactly does that follow?
Well, because the new paradigm says that the world, there is no such thing as empty space. There's no such thing as vacuum. Even what physicists call the quantum vacuum is not empty space. It's more like what the Buddhists talk about when they say a space that is empty but yet contains everything. And this is not a sort of a contradiction. It just seems like it. Because what is really empty space doesn't exist. The field, the cosmic field, is a plenum. It's not a vacuum. And that plenum creates the way the interactions take place in space and time. And that's the software. That's the algorithm. That's the code of the way the universe plays out, evolution plays out. So everything is given, basically, in that plenum, which itself, if I want to get too technical, but it itself is beyond space and time. But it informs, it acts on space-time. So the important point is, and the primary question, is that if everything in the cosmos is given, the information for everything is there, and the question is to access it. How do you access it? When you, in the new medicine, for example, you try to get to a deeper level of consciousness when you access information that you know you can get. Sometimes people call it the Akashic Records. You can access, I myself call it the deep vacuum, the Akashic Field. Then, of course, you can actually use that information. The information, how the manual, the blueprint, if you like, also those are somewhat old paradigm terms, all those things exist. They are all there in the world. It's a question of being able to read it and get beyond the surface, beyond the superficial elements that you perceive, get down deeper, and then you'll find that you are part of a deeper reality where all things coexist, all things co-evolve. And if you can tap into that, then you find guidance how you can best situate yourself in this holographic wholeness and oneness, which is really the new concept of the universe.
That new concept has evidence supporting it that it might be useful for you to recount so that we can understand that this is not just a spiritual but a scientific idea.
Well, okay, so what does the new physics tell you? I mean, basically, you're talking about fundamental issues here to turn to physics, and then afterwards, you can turn to life sciences, psychology, social sciences, etc. But the fundamental, if you want to talk about the cosmos, you have to talk to cosmology, which is physical cosmology. In the new physics, which the dominant concept is quantum physics, quantum theory, you ask a quantum scientist to say, what is the basis of all this? Where is matter? And it would say, like with Bertrand Russell, who said it at the time, although for some time ago, he said, it doesn't matter. There is no such thing as matter in according to the world picture of the new sciences. So what you have is energy. But you have energy based on information moving on the way that it is formed. This is why David Bohm, the great physicist, talked about how the world that we observe is being informed. He spells this with a hyphen, information. This deeper dimension, the deeper informational field in the universe informs all things that occur. So instead of thinking about little bits or pieces of matter rushing about mechanically, you have a plenum, you have a total field which has no gaps. There is no places where it wouldn't be present. It's a holographic wholeness where all the information is given at the same time. So we can say many more things about that, but keep in mind that the new concept that is arising now and the new theories that are coming about in quantum cosmology and quantum field theory, etc., is that of a holographic universe. Space-time is holographic. And that is just to say one word why that is the case and why that's interesting, is because in a hologram, all the information that produces the image is present at all points. You can take a holographic film and you illuminate any small part of it, anywhere at all, and you'll find that the image, the total image, emerges. It's there at all points. There's no part of it where the full information wouldn't be present. So the information that runs this universe, which is the software of the universe, if you like, that is present everywhere. So this is a very, very different concept from the idea that you have matter sort of being acted upon by outside energy. There's no outside, there is only inside in this universe. And the inside is, I would say in the simplest possible term, would be informed energy. Energy that is behaving, creating patterns which are in accordance with these fundamental laws of how things operate, how things evolve in space and time. So it's a very, very different concept. And the basic ideas come from the observation of the behavior of things. Now, you don't observe quanta itself. You observe the effects of quanta. You don't see quanta. They're far too small for that. You have certain traces of quanta. And then you have many other fields, many other concepts which you don't see itself. So you no longer just sit there and look at like you would be looking at a machine of some kind and you see how it works. You don't see the machine itself. You see the effects of it. The simplest illustration of that is the concept of field, electromagnetic fields. The way we can talk now on the phone or on the internet is through electromagnetic fields. So those are the effects, but nobody has seen the field itself. You see the effect, just like the gravitation. You think you drop an object to the ground and you see gravitation? No. You see the effect of the law of gravitation. The law of gravitation is a universal phenomenon. It's there everywhere, like electromagnetism is there everywhere. And so the universe is basically an unobserved and unobservable wholeness of which the observed elements are those that meet our eye and ear and senses, and we try to understand the whole by inference, by deduction from what we actually observe. And sorry if this sounds complicated, but actually it's not any different from the classical spiritual notions. You know who was one of the most known people who came up with this concept? It was an individual by the name of Plato. You recall that in one of the famous dialogues of Plato, he talks about the cave in which prisoners sit, and they are chained in such a position that they can't see behind them. They can only face the wall. But behind them is a source of light. And everything that happens in the cave throws shadows on the wall. So they look at the wall, and they see the shadows. And they believe that's the real world. They try to understand the real world on the basis of the shadows. But the real world is actually behind them. They would have to turn around. They would have to get enlightened to be able to see that real world. So that's a parable. That's one of the first ones. But there was also the notion of the akasha, the deepest dimension, out of which all the other elements and dimensions of both arise 5,000 years ago in the Hindu rishis. There was the cosmos idea of Ptolemy's and the Ptolemaic idea. And there was Pythagoras' similar concept, Plotinus, etc. I mean, this is an old notion. The interesting thing is that it is coming in at the leading edge of the new sciences. The world is not what you see. What you see is the effect of the world. It's basically a simple concept. It's an old concept, but it's revolutionary because it's a new paradigm. It's not at all what the old paradigm used to be.
What do you think the most immediate and powerful implications of this are for you and perhaps for our listeners in terms of how we relate to reality and how we live our lives? Can we tap into this deeper level in a very direct way, or does it require the same long and deep self-transformative path of practice that the ancient spiritual traditions have always pointed to?
It takes a longer practice just to get eliminate what we've accumulated as mistaken assumptions. Children don't have any problem stepping into it. They are intuitive. They grasp right away, and they have the first few years of a child's life, up to the age of 6 roughly, children even come up with memories of past lives, and they appear to reincarnate others because there is a much wider range of information from the cosmos. We have to enter into altered states to pick up that level of information. Native people have that. Deeply spiritual people have that. I think great artists have that capacity. I think great scientists, actually, when they recognize, and what they do nowadays is this, the deeper reality in the cosmos, then they actually operate in that. So you mentioned a couple of things that I've been doing in my life. I've always been guided by intuition. I've always been guided this sense that what I can perceive with my senses is only a fleeting image. And underneath is there is something much deeper and much more profound and much more real. And that given me the orientation for exploring ideas in terms of finding the way which you can explain finally that what we see. The explanation is not on the same level as what we explain. The exploration is deeper, above or below what we see. So I think if we can tap into this, and I know you're asking for practical guidance, but you are the spiritual person, I think you know that best of all, we can enter into this deeper dimension of the cosmos where all the information is present. And when we enter it, then we follow what the Easterners call, the Eastern healers call the chi or the ki. We find information that means health in our body. We orient ourselves, perhaps in some way intuitively, but it's a healthy orientation. And to my mind, what we need in today's world is to return, to some extent, to this deeper natural orientation, to find ourselves again in the world, recognize ourselves as part of the world, and recognize that we are in communication with the world. Communication, interchange is the basic notion here. It's not mechanical interaction. It's not one thing pushing and pulling another. It's one thing informing the other. If you can recognize that, our minds will open up. You get what the ancients call enlightenment, or a deeper vision, or a higher vision, and we can find ourselves again at home in a universe that seems to be very strange and alienated in terms of the previous paradigm.
Do you see an awakening, in a sense, taking place among people who are more spiritually awake or intuitively alive or in touch with this deeper Akashic field? And do you see that as having a transformative effect on the culture of the world? I ask that question only because it seems in some respects as though there is a very advanced leading edge to culture, but it isn't yet powerful enough to affect the large-scale choices of human beings on the planet, and our crisis just seems to be accumulating, and there does seem to need to be a tipping point. I'm curious to hear how you see that coming about and how those of us who are practitioners who see the inner work and the outer work as being inextricably linked, you know, how do you see us being able to make that kind of a powerful, widespread difference?
Well, you know, let's talk about the old paradigm and the new paradigm. And the old paradigm, in a sense, has a defensive reaction now. It tries to protect itself. That means that the old consciousness, this is me and that's you. I'm here and the rest of the world, and it's either an enemy or perhaps at best neutral. With some luck, some of it can be friendly, but it's not me. And it's separate. I'm just responsible for myself, perhaps for my family, perhaps for my enterprise, but I'm not part of a larger whole. And that's the old paradigm, and it fights back. And it takes us into crisis because it creates more and more concentration of wealth and power. Fewer and fewer people hold the reins of power. The activists are things and can do things, so a large majority is pushed to the side. Now, this is not quite true, because at the outside, at the margins, at the periphery, there is a tremendous awakening coming about. It's people who are recognizing that it doesn't go like this, something has to change. And they don't yet have that percussive element of breaking through the defenses of the old, because the system is not yet in sufficient crisis. This sounds odd. It sounds like I'm putting my faith in deeper crisis. Actually, I do, because things change when they are ripe for change. Until then, there is a tremendous effect of reticence, that a tremendous attempt to defend oneself. People feel at home, particularly when they have done well. They feel well. They feel at home in what they have. They are afraid of losing it. People have power, don't want to lose power. People have wealth, don't want to lose their wealth. So there is a resistance to change, to deep, profound change. But that change happens when it's right, when the time is right. The time is right when there is a more serious break in the old, when the old becomes less and less capable of being maintained. Then the change comes, then the mutations, the alterations, the transformations come from the periphery, and they take over the center. You know, it's curious, but this is the way also biological evolution occurs. It used to be thought that the genome, you know, the genetic information mutates little by little, and then it creates a new species. It turns out it's not the case. The old species maintains itself to the bitter end. What happens is that in the periphery, in the margins, there are constantly mutations occurring that are not affected by the center. They are freer because they're outside. And these mutations, they become all of a sudden become powerful when the time has come. Until then, they are known as the mutant monsters, as the hopeful monsters they are known in biology. They are monsters in terms of the old paradigm. But they are the harbingers. They are the pioneers of the new paradigm, of the new way of looking at it, new way of organizing ourselves. I think this kind of transformation is occurring now all over the world, it seems to me. There's hardly a society where it wouldn't be occurring. As soon as people are just a bit sensitive, they realize that the way we have been conducting our affairs in this world doesn't lead to a sustainable world. it has to be changed, and it has to be changed profoundly. But you don't do it only by wanting it. You do it when the time forces you to change, when it doesn't go anymore in the old way. And these breakdowns, the signs of this breakdown, are there all over the world. Not only in Afghanistan and the Middle East, they are in the Far East, in the Latin America. Wherever you look, they are in the heart of Europe also, in America. There are breaks, there are cracks in this kind of a egg that we have, eggshell that we have built for ourselves. So I have this kind of a converse or inverse optimism. I say the times will be worse than they will be now, and that will be the occasion when we can change. But let's be prepared. I mean, let's know which way we could change. Let's see how we could add, should add. What is the right way, the functional, the healthy way to be and to relate to others before it forces us to choose. In other words, let's listen more to our instincts, to our basic insights. It's there. It's there in all of us. If we just open up our mind and we don't try to get guidance from that, whether you call it Jesus or Jehovah or the Buddha or Muhammad or whatever, there is a source of wisdom in the cosmos. The cosmos is built on information, the way things run in a proper way. If we open ourselves up to that, I think we don't have to just engage in idle speculations and doctrines. We can feel what it's like. I think basically we are all ethical people. We are all humane people. We don't enjoy hurting others or harming the world. I think if we just give ourselves a chance, we will take pleasure in being a positive part of the world, in giving and not only taking. So I'm optimistic as regards human nature, but I'm pessimistic as regards the current holding pattern of the dominant powers. And those have to still break open. And I think that break is bound to come, and we better be prepared for it.
Mm. And when you say we better be prepared for it, you know, some people get images of our prototyping ways of being with one another in communities that are more spiritually uplifted, perhaps more environmentally sustainable, and even perhaps self-sufficient. Other ways of getting prepared for it might be simply to bring a spiritual or consciousness awakening more broadly into the culture. Perhaps all these things are necessary. Evolution tries out so many things simultaneously. Are there particular activities that inspire you most and that give you most hope?
Well, I think there is one word that is coming more and more into use, which I think signifies what we really need, and that word is love. I think the connection that we feel to others is far more than the connection we feel just to one person. The connection that we can feel is to others around us, to our community, to nature, to humanity, to the planet, to the cosmos, you know, I mean, a different level, different concentric spheres where we can feel belongingness. And I think this idea of relating to each other in a win-win way, recognizing that when I do something positive to others, I do it to myself. And the same thing with the negative. If I harm others, I ultimately harm myself. If I feel that I am the others, there is no absolute boundary between me and others. This is part of what the physicists call entanglement, you know, the close connection between the smallest measurable units in the world, which are called the quantum, the quanta. This occurs in the physical world. I think it occurs in the cells of our body. All these cells are working together. If some cells don't work well, you have a disease. If some cells prefer not to be, I say prefer, but actually turn out then not to communicate with the rest of the organism, what do we have? We have cancer. And that eventually kills the organism. So love is connection. Love is recognition. Love is knowing that we are one, ultimately. So these are really spiritual concepts, but they are backed by and supported by the latest insights into how complex systems operate, how they evolve in this world. Ultimately, the whole biosphere is such a complex system. and it has all these elements of emotional, conscious, subconscious elements, feelings, rationality, and all that. But then we got right down to it. The ultimate element is this sense of my belonging to you and to us. There is no singular sense in which I can talk about an individual as one. There's no sense in which we can talk about even evolution or development as one. There's only co-evolution, co-development, and us, we and us. It has been said by many philosophers, but it's becoming realized in the world, and that is the source of the greatest hope that we have.
I am inspired and made joyful to hear you talk so directly in terms that I would normally think of as spiritual, partly because I know you've come to these not as a person with spiritual attitudes and beliefs intending to superimpose them on the data, but that you're simply a synthetic, holographic, intuitive genius who has been looking at the patterns of science and physics and intuiting the implications of the new paradigms that are showing themselves through the different anomalies, and that in some sense, although your heart is open, this is a conclusion that you've come to really through examining the patterns in the evidence. And it raises a question, because there is a certain fundamentalistic dogma in the scientific circles that tends to exclude this feeling dimension, does not respect it. How do you look at that tendency to exclude you might say, the more uplifting, spiritual, intuitive dimensions of being and these holistic observations in a dogmatic way? Do you see that those of us who are simply awakening as whole beings with heart intelligence as well as head intelligence are simply going to have to continue to do our work, and at a certain moment the crisis will open a window of opportunity for love to be potent and to reclaim its dominion, so to speak?
Well, but in the meanwhile, we can, as using your terms, we can all awaken. I would say we can all gain further insight into what there is in the world. The world is not mechanical. The world is highly interactive. The world is a hologram. Okay, so you can take that coming from quantum physics, but you can take it from coming from your heart, from your perceptions. I always let myself be guided by an intuition. If I find that a thought that I have is fertile, it's something that's worth exploring, I try exploring it. If it doesn't lead anywhere, which happens, then I throw it out. I say that's not the way. But then I try something else. And if it's something comes from some place which is not the rational mind, it comes from someplace deeper, an intuition, a sudden insight. You know, the Germans, which Einstein was quoting also very frequently, called Einfall. Einfall means literally falling in, and that's a word for insight, for sudden insight. And as Einstein said, this is what the basis of all knowledge. And then comes the second part of working it out, you know, testing it. But don't forget, I came from music as a child. I was a concert pianist and earned my living like that until I was in my early 30s. Of course, I studied in the meanwhile. I did my work, my degrees. I even wrote books. But my livelihood was from the time I was four or five years old, it was music. And music, if it's not intuitive, then it's just mechanical. Then it doesn't make sense. Why do it? You know, music has to speak to you. It has to be spontaneous. The same, I think, with all forms of art. I think, to me, the essential, the meaning of awakening, enlightening, is all that, is allowing the information that is there in the world, in this Akashic field, or Akashic record, to come to you, to open yourself up to it. as children always do, as artists as ourselves always do, as intuitive people do. If you can allow that, and then you get these basic ideas and the basic sense of who we are and what the world is, then you can try to speculate, to try to work out, what does that mean for me? You know, it's not that difficult, because it means that if you're a businessman, you play win-win games. You don't sort of impoverish your neighbor or try to outdo your competitor to the extent that you kill it. You don't excise a thick cell in your body. You try to transform it, which is also possible, you know, in many cases. In many instances, whatever you do, you see that there is another way. I recently attended a conference in China, in Shanghai, and it came directly from the top leadership. The whole initiative came. It's called the World Cultural Forum, and the top leadership, the party committee, said that this conference should be oriented towards soft power interaction in the world. It's a very interesting idea, actually. It comes from the U.S., from a sociologist, and it says that instead of killing each other, shooting each other, let's try to communicate. Let's try to use culture to find our joint interests. So soft power interaction, I think this is an insight that can allow you to find your way in the world, because communication, information exchange is soft. Energies being shooting at people, bullets or explosives, that's the hard power. And that is what is so counterproductive these days. We try to gain understanding through interactions, through communication. That's learning. We don't teach people by forcing them what to do. We try to learn. We learn together. And that, I think, is the insight that we need. So I'm optimistic that more and more this kind of insight is dawning on people. We are entering another age, which some colleagues of mine, and I've written also a joint book of those, that title, The Akashic Age, the age in which this deep dimension becomes the dominant influence in our life. And that could be the old idea in a new guise, the old idea of joining together, as Jesus said, with love, as the Buddha said, in co-evolution. In every big religion, it's there. And you know that much more than I do. But the point is that it is the recipe, it is the right way to do it, not a hard means, not power, not aggression, and not blueprints, preconceived ideas, but emerging, allowing ourselves to immerse ourselves in this cosmic sea of which we are a part. Just recognize it. I think that's the way to go.
I'm finding myself reflecting on the implications of entanglement and the nature of consciousness and this zero-point field or quantum vacuum, and the very nature of consciousness and my participation. I know that in my own practice, as I have become more and more capable of living from a disposition of love more radically and more completely, as I've, in a sense, made that choice again and again and again at deeper levels of my being, to some degree it seems as though I have magnetized or summoned forth from the world experiences and relationships and people and circumstances that have harmonized with that and made my own life transformed in various ways. But when I extrapolate this and I think about the world crisis and the problems that we all face together, I look at examples of, for example, you know, counterexamples like that of Tibet, where a community of very advanced practitioners who were praying and loving and awakening in ways that we now can only celebrate and be almost in awe of, still were overwhelmed and subjected to a cultural genocide by the Chinese even in our lifetimes. So how do you account for the positive and negative evidence relating to, you know, everyone's experience around this?
And I think we can sort of infer that from what you already said without commenting. I don't want to comment any political event if they're far too sensitive. But I just want to point out the old paradigm is mechanical interaction. Whoever has more power can subjugate the one who has less power. And that's still operating in the world. That's why we need a change, because we're operating in that way. And we create more and more damage, more and more breakdowns, more and more crisis in the world. So the new paradigm is to pull together, to recognize that on this web of life, in this biosphere, we are basically all part of one system. We are part of each other. In that case, whoever has a higher consciousness, okay, find himself or herself more at home, more in the ambient, in the environment that he or she prefers, and find more and more happy solutions. I think that even a solution of a subjugated people who do not either commit suicide or just fight back with the same means, I think it's a good example. Whoever throws the first stone, I think, as Jesus said, you know, is the one who is guilty. We, I think, with our new insights, with our new paradigm thinking, can create a new world. The old world is still around us, but the old world is creating such problems that it's bound to break down. An odd way of saying it is perhaps it should break down sooner rather than later, but it's a risk. It's always a risk with breakdown. What does it take to transform? What price do we pay? So I think our best bet is to reform ourselves and be the new paradigm that we want to see in the world. That's a paraphrase of Gandhi, you know, be the change you want to see in the world. I would say act according to this new paradigm of information, of entanglement expressed by love and oneness. I think that's the lesson. If you can act like that, I think the world will be saved from ultimate collapse, because we are heading in a bad direction. But if there is this revolution, this cultural transformation, pushing forward, moving forward, I think that we can still have time to transform.
I'm entirely congruent with this, and one can even look at the example of the Tibetans and say, well, yes, they became a sacrifice, but their teachings have come out to inspire and instruct people all over the world and in a way to uplift this very paradigm. So perhaps sustaining our simplicity of trust and faith and love is the whole point. Do you have time for one more question?
Well, quickly, please, because I have tomorrow morning, I have to leave from the airport, and I still have to finish a manuscript or some of my mind-boggling situation. But please, if there's a question, let's try to see if you can deal with it.
Okay. Well, this is one that I mentioned to you before. I interviewed a brilliant scientist, Terence Deacon, who suggested that what we call human consciousness is not the same as the interiority of humans or lower animals or plants or even inanimate holons like molecules or atoms, but is something that has emerged again and again only over the arc of evolution, and that the only thing that goes all the way down to the simplest, earliest physical structures is the propensity toward emergence of so-called higher potentials, including sentience and subjectivity and consciousness and values and superconsciousness. And meanwhile, though, you know, it's the testimony of our greatest sages and mystical realizers that they awaken as the very consciousness, which is the nature of the whole cosmos and has been from the beginning. So they seemingly contradict Deacon's emergentist view.
Well, that's a familiar view. It's called radical emergentism. Somehow, you know, things emerge suddenly out of a previous condition and can be reduced back to the previous condition. I have held such views for many years. I don't hold them anymore. I now believe that the traces, the seeds of consciousness are there in the quanta, are there in the field. I think they become more and more articulated in the course of time. I think once you can, because he, as a canonical trend, as a basic trend in the universe, is the sensitivity of different elements, of the various elements of the space and time, becoming tuned to each other, becoming more and more sensitive, reactive, prompting each other, perceiving each other. Perception is a kind of a thing that happens at the level of the quanta. You know, when you measure one quanta, and it was in the same state previously, you can shoot it no matter how far away, the other part of it, the other half of it, and the other half still perceive it, will still act as though it would be measuring that quantum, you know. Direct effect over space and time, sensitivity, is there at the heart of reality, and it becomes articulated, differentiated, it becomes consciousness in the course of time. So what is there, what Clive Baxter, for example, called primary perception in plants. He measured the reaction of plants to various things in the environment and found that the plants react. So there is some kind of perception even in plants. It's there, everywhere. I think our consciousness is a highly articulate form of this. It adds various elements, reflective consciousness, self-consciousness, what Bach has called cosmic consciousness. There are various degrees of it. But I think consciousness is there at the very heart of the universe. So I think it just emerges more and more, becomes more and more clear. But you can't say it's below this there isn't any and above it that there is. I think it's there all the way.
Well, that certainly corresponds with my own internal realization. I resonate so much. Thank you so much, Irvin. I know I speak for everybody who's listening and expressing just the most sincere appreciation for you taking this time to join us. And
thanks, Terry, for inspiring conversation. These are, I think, the issues that we cover that we ought to be thinking about. And the more we think about it, the better chances we have that we come to kind of conclusions that reflect not only an abstract and artificial idea, but something that is really there in the world, because we have to just think about the world, open ourselves. If you do that, I think we'll be better people, and we'll help the world around us. And that, I think, is our basic objective.
Yes, absolutely. That's certainly what inspires me. Well, please don't hang up, everyone. Irvin, if you need to go, it's okay now, but I have some important announcements about upcoming interviews and how to find out more about Irvin's work and my own.
So keep on.
Okay. Well, thank you, Irvin. Goodbye.
You'll be carrying on. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye. Well, I want to make sure that you know how to find out more about Irvin's work. You can read his most recent book, The Self-Actualizing Cosmos. Also, there's The Akasha Paradigm and The Akasha Experience, which focuses on science and the cosmic memory field. His classic work is The System's View of the World, and he has a biography, Simply Genius, and, of course, many others. There are 70 books in all. You can find out more about him and his personal activities at E-R-V-I-N, Irvin, L-A-S-Z, L-A-S-Z-L-O, ervinlaszlo.com. And you can find out more about the activities of the Club of Budapest at clubofbudapest.com, clubofbudapest.com. Additionally, I want you to be aware of some of my own offerings. As my inner life has continued to deepen, I've been listening not only to God, but also to the mystery, the universal divine source, the zero-point field, love itself. But I've also been learning to trust and listen at new depths to the voice of my own soul. And I've long recognized that there can seem to be two different kinds of mystical practice, one that opens beyond self into love and freedom, and another that surrenders into the depths of the psyche, the natural world, and one's personal and soul nature. But recently, as my own practice has taken a soulful turn, many new understandings about the relationship of these two dimensions of mystical life have been clarifying. So I've begun writing and teaching about it, and I call it integral soul work. And earlier this year, I decided to share this work with two small circles of students. If you're interested to learn more about this, you can go to integralsoulwork.com and sign up for a free download of a talk that I gave when I introduced those groups. integralsoulwork.com. Also, I'll be facilitating a half-day seminar in New York City in less than 2 weeks on Saturday, July 19th from 1 to 5 p.m. You can find out more details by going to terrypatton.com and clicking events. That'll link you to the main event page, which you can also find directly at integralalignment.org. And also, you're invited to experience Integral Soul Work with me in person and in depth at a five-day workshop that I'll be facilitating at Esalen, Embodying the Intelligence of Your Heart and Soul. And this will be August 17th through 22nd. In May, I taught a four-day workshop on Integral Soul Work in Freiburg, Germany, and something really beautiful, deep, and miraculous occurred there. It seems to be a magical time in this work, so you're warmly encouraged to join me for that. I'll be joined by Master Somatic Therapist Joanne Lavasio, and you can find out more details about this and my other work by going to terrypatton.com and clicking events. Coming up on Beyond Awakening, I'll be interviewing cell biologist Bruce Lipton, the author of The Biology of Belief and The Honeymoon Effect, on transforming human culture via neurobiology. That'll be July 24th. And the remarkable Swiss spiritual teacher and philanthropist Annette Kaiser will be with me on August 10th. Also, please look ahead. In October, I'll be interviewing the remarkable Tibetan Buddhist teacher Reggie Ray. Thank you so much for joining Irvin and me today. It's been a pleasure to have this time. Take care.